Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today we're going to finish the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, written by the researchers at the Nation of Islam, and you can buy it through them, and I encourage you to do so if you want the footnotes and see a lot of them. They have a million pictures in it. It's volume 3 in there, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. 1 and 2 dealt with slavery and Jewish domination of the slavery economy, essentially. Not just the trade in slaves, that's volume 1, but documented from Jewish sources. But Jews in the Old South and their relations with blacks up through volume 3, the Leo Frank case that we've been dealing with. So we'll do pages 465 to what I'm going to call the end, 487, the epilogue, and then there's, after that, there's the Black Unforgotten George's Lynching Victims. I'm not going to read those, but there's four pages of them. And who's who in the Leo Frank case, inset pictures, and a long list of people, most of them with little inset photos, a nice little thing they do in here. They also have a Leo Frank case timeline on 500 up through 505, so there, and a selected bibliography, and of course, and finally an index. So all kinds of nice extras on this, really an excellent book today. But we'll do the final section and then the epilogue, what Leo Frank represents. And the epilogue following it is basically a letter from Mary Fagan's parents, her mother and her stepfather. So you get their views to kind of conclude the book, which is kind of a nice note from NOI. What Leo Frank represents, two epigraphs. And again, this is only about 19, 20 pages, so it won't take too awful long. No longer shall your name be called Jacob. Rather, Israel shall be your name. For you have struggled with the divine and with men, and you have prevailed. Genesis 32, 28, 29. What happened to Mary Fagan was terrible. What happened to Leo Frank was even more terrible. Jew Harry Golden wrote that in A Little Girl Is Dead in 1965. Mary Fagan's murder solved. First subsection. On August 25th, 1913, B'nai B'rith president and factory superintendent Leo Max Frank was convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan in a trial that, by all objective standards, up to that time was one of the fairest ever accorded a citizen in the United States of America. A century later, a full and impartial re-examination of the evidence will still lead fair-minded analysts to these inescapable conclusions. Five bullet points. First, that on April 26, 1913, Leo Max Frank did in fact murder 13-year-old Mary Fagan. Second, that Leo Max Frank attempted to elude prosecution by implicating two innocent black men for the murder he himself committed. Three, that Leo Max Frank was a racist who built his legal defense using overtly racist arguments and deceptions. Four, that Leo Max Frank's legal team and supporters committed a series of unethical and illegal acts that included bribery, perjury, the planting of and tampering with evidence, and even attempted murder, and the obstruction and subversion of justice at every level of the case. Finally, five, that anti-Semitism played no part in the trial or appeals of Leo Max Frank, anti-Semitism in quotes, and was invented by pro-Frank propagandists long after the trial for political purposes. There was no exodus of Jews from Atlanta, nor was there ever violence against them or their property as a result of the Frank affair. Moving on from the bullets. Author Steve Oney's claim that the Leo Frank affair was, quote, America's worst case of anti-Semitism, unquote, has no basis in reality. Jewish scholar Dr. Albert S. Lindemann is clear, quote, the available evidence puts into question the assertion that anti-Semitism, whether as a product of a self-perpetuating fantasy divorced from reality, or as a reflection of tensions in the real world, was of decisive importance in the Frank case. For Jews had, for a century and a half, intimately participated in the political, business, and social affairs of Georgia without any hint, trace, or suggestion of anti-Semitic bias. Throughout the South, they had been judges, jurors, court officers, lawyers, prosecutors, mayors, councilmen, and held every other position of influence in Southern society. Harry Golden, himself a Southerner and a scholar of the Frank case, wrote that the Jew is really in an enviable position. Quote, he is, quote, our Jew to small-town Southerners, and they often take care of him with a zeal and devotion otherwise bestowed only on the Confederate monument in the square. How ironic is that, reading that in 2017, when the Jews are championing the ripping down of monuments by the blacks? So Jews swing either way. It's always what is good for Jews in the moment, and they don't hesitate to tell any kind of lie. And that's what the Leo Frank case represents. There is no legitimate reason to suggest that the Texas-born, Brooklyn-reared, German-Jewish Leo Frank, a man whose family proudly carried Confederate credentials, was viewed any differently from his white Southern neighbors. The one man who invested the most money, time, and resources to clear Leo Frank of his murder conviction, Jewish businessman Albert Lasker, father of modern advertising, as he called himself, was asked very directly in an interview in 1937, were you convinced of his innocence? Are you convinced of it now? Lasker's answer is alarming. Quote, no, at no point was I convinced of his innocence, because in the circumstantial evidence case, that is impossible unless you were with the man every second. There was no way of our telling whether any man was guilty or innocent, of course. After he and his colleagues met the prisoner, Lasker made this admission. Quote, it was very hard for us to be fair to him. He impressed us as a sexual pervert. Now, he may not have been, or rather a homosexual, sick, or something like that. Of course, I am telling you this off the record. His interviewer, Boyden Sparks, S-P-A-R-K-E-S, summarized their meeting with Lasker. After talking to the convicted murderer, Leo M. Frank, who talks them deaf, dumb, and blind, all the men take a violent dislike to him. Mr. Lasker says he hopes that if freed, he will fall and break his neck. Says, I hope he gets off, and when he does, I hope he steps in a banana peel, is what he said. We've heard that earlier. You got to remember, Leo Frank's a shrimpy little dude and a pervert, so I think comparisons to Anthony Weiner are not unapropos, as they always say. Although, to my knowledge, Anthony Weiner has not actually strangled anybody yet. All the investigative bodies involved in the case, most notably an attorney and two private detective agencies, hired by Frank himself, publicly affirmed the guilt of their own client. There is no basis, therefore, on which to demand from the general public a higher assessment of Leo Max Frank than that held by his most zealous defenders. Hey, look, everybody who knows him says he's scum, all right? Next, the significance of Leo Frank to the Jewish people. I don't know why they don't just say Jews. You should always just say Jews rather than Jewish people. Quite dramatically, the Leo Frank affair has become the very essence and full expression of the black-Jewish relationship, crystallized in a moment in time. The involvement of black witnesses in such a high-profile trial, where their citizenship was legally acknowledged, made it a potential bellwether of American race relations. The impressive and unshaken testimonies of Newt Lee and James Connolly, the two men that Leo Frank and his backers attempted to implicate in the murder of Mary Fagan, framed them both, showed the attentive white public that blacks had a degree of humanity they had been loath to concede. For Jews, however, the granting of this American civil right to blacks was considered by Jewish leadership and rank-and-file Jews to be an infringement on their civil rights. Scholar Leonard Dinnerstein acknowledges this point when he wrote that anti-Semitism in Atlanta, quote, was evident in the widespread acceptance of Negro Jim Connolly's testimony. the only reason you're accepting it when you're racist just like we are is because you hate Jews. What's more, some Jews insisted that the circumstances that led to Frank's trial, conviction, and lynching were driven not by the overwhelming evidence against Frank, but by some larger force. Some argue that Frank as a factory manager was resented as, quote, a symbol of alien industrialism. Others theorize that Atlantans saw Conley as someone who, quote, belonged to them, testifying against an outsider. Still others say that Georgians doggedly pursued Leo Frank, not because they thought he was guilty, but because the conviction and hanging of a black man would not have been adequate recompense for the tragic loss of their virginal white southern belle. A wealthy northern Jew was a more even trade-off, their theory goes, for the crime that enraged the entire white South. As Lenora E. Berson, B-E-R-S-O-N, crudely phrased it, the crime, quote, demanded a villain blacker than any Negro could ever aspire to be. Many other treatments amount to variations on those major themes, but all evade the true significance of the episode. And all these theories only complicate a simple reality. If whites had intended to, quote, send the Jews a message, they would have reveled in the opportunity to treat the B'nai B'rith president exactly like a nigger. And Frank would have received no court proceeding, that is, none of the 13 judicial hearings that he actually did receive, and he would have been shot and castrated, his fingers, toes, and testicles displayed in a jar on the counter of the City Five and Dime, if he were not first burned alive at the stake. Jews have turned Leo Frank into a powerful emblem of a much-touted Jewish American victimhood, even though their extraordinary American success story is almost totally devoid of any instances of injustice. Up to the murder of Leo Frank in 1915, the most significant example of American, quote, anti-Semitism was an episode that occurred 38 years earlier in 1877. A powerful Jewish banker named Joseph Seligman was denied accommodations at an elite vacation resort hotel in upstate New York. The insult was considered so egregious that the New York Times referred to it as the, quote, sensation at Saratoga. And Brandeis University professor Jonathan Sarna, S-A-R-N-A, called the affair, quote, shocking. So that was the worst thing that ever happened to Jews up before Leo Frank, that one of their elite got denied access to a hotel. At the very same time, Jewish-owned hotels across America, without hesitation or a sense of irony, refused admission of blacks as a matter of policy, and on the basis of skin color alone. A snubbing of a Jewish millionaire at a ritzy northern hotel, Seligman quickly found other local accommodations, and the hotel faced an international backlash, seemed a trivial inconvenience compared with the lynchings, massacres, pogroms, and wide assortment of discriminations that blacks, Indians, Asians, and Latinos considered shocking. Even Leonard Dinnerstein had to admit that American Jews, prior to the Frank case, quote, had experienced no organized persecution and had found unlimited economic opportunities. In fact, Jews were so well received and prodigiously successful that some referred to the American slavery-based South as their New Jerusalem, in quotes, a veritable promised land. Dr. Sarna affirms that if the United States, quote, has not been utter heaven for Jews, it has been as far from hell as Jews in the diaspora have ever known. Nevertheless, that unprecedented social, political, and economic freedom unloosed a troubling predatory trait that has haunted the Jewish image. Jewish Americans were deeply involved in the African slave trade, the plantation system of the South, and the Jim Crow system of apartheid that followed the post-war years. Indeed, much of Sarna's utter heaven can be attributed to the massive profits generated by Jewish merchants in places and industries that were utter hell for black Africans, the indigenous peoples, and the many who fell victim to the most savage system of slavery and genocide in the annals of human history. Jewish wealth utterly exploded, utterly in italics, exploded as a direct result of their trade in human beings and their marketing of slave-based produce such as sugar, tobacco, and especially cotton. Remember, cotton is king in the first half of the 1800s in the South, where it grows. This horrific racial history presented the Jewish people with an unsolvable dilemma. It irreconcilably conflicted with the unambiguous description of the children of Israel found in Genesis 15, 13, and 14 as the despised and rejected strangers, persecuted for 400 years in a land that is not theirs. After centuries of claiming victim status everywhere on earth, Jews had not been humbled by their travails, but instead had become the cruelest of pharaohs in their new world, quote unquote. By the time of the Civil War, the image of the poor, persecuted Jews had been so distorted by extensive Jewish slaveholding that one of their wealthiest was denounced by a Gentile on the floor of the U.S. Senate as an, quote, Israelite with the principles of an Egyptian, close quote, footnote 1198. That's in The Secret Relationship 1, book 1 of this series. You can get them all from Nation of Islam. The role biblically outlined for them as the children of Israel had become unrecognizable in every American sense. Leo Frank's unfortunate felony in 1913 offered a chance to refashion a tragic murder into a Jewish persecution narrative that fit the biblical model, one that the Jewish people could and would adopt as the symbol most representative of their American experience. The incident was big enough, and the subject, a B'nai B'rith leader, important enough to be used to give the Jewish people an American resume of anti-Semitism, which at the time of the Leo Frank affair was non-existent. In America, Jews had no natural enemies, and Leo Frank's martyrdom, real or imagined, provided the unique opportunity for Jews to create an imaginary but convenient oppressor. In their ritualistic retelling of the Leo Frank episode, Jews are careful not to emphasize that their victimhood is at the hands of the white Gentile with whom they have always partnered in wielding American racial power. That relationship is still too economically profitable and politically precious to disturb. Instead, this Leo Frank-style American Jewish martyrdom comes at the hands of the, quote, cunning, bestial Negro, unquote, James Jim Conley, who has maligned not just a single Jewish pencil factory manager, but the entire Jewish people. And this makes the Jew, as the oppressed victim of the lowest of the lowliest race, the utmost American victim. In italics, the utmost American victim. The Leo Frank saga enables the Jews to publicly reiterate their victimhood by venting their rage at, quote, black anti-Semites. With no adverse racial consequences from their white Gentile brethren. Whites are not blamed in any more than an oblique, inferential way, and in fact they are sometimes cast, as in Alfred Uhry's play, Parade, and Ben Loderman's PBS drama, docudrama, The People vs. Leo Frank, as co-victims of Conley's voodoo-like wiles. According to Frank's devotees, he was a Jewish martyr made to pay the penalty for a crime committed by an African-American man. In this construction, the white men who actually made Frank pay, who arrested, indicted, tried, convicted, sentenced, imprisoned, and hanged Leo Frank, escaped Jewish antipathy in place of the vulnerable black man, whose race for 400 years has paid dearly for Jewish survival and Jewish success. Well, Parade does defame the prosecutor Hugh Dorsey as well. For a full century, the malicious hoax of black anti-Semitism has been the defining characteristic of the so-called black-Jewish relationship. Honest and legitimate criticism of Jewish behavior, inimical to black interest, hostile to it, has been reinterpreted by Jews as anti-Semitism. Well, that's their little trick that they play on everybody. Everybody who resents their obnoxious anti-his race behavior is made an anti-Semite, and that defines him in the Jews' media. Not because it is that, but because the criticism is more easily repressed if it is characterized as part of a long history of bigotry and prejudice, quote, against the Jews. Blacks let me intone that differently. Blacks who have sojourned in a land not theirs in servitude to white Gentiles and Jews, who cruelly afflicted them for 400 years, are the only people that fit every condition outlined in the well-known biblical prophecy. Yet it is the truth-telling blacks like Jim Conley who have been cast as persecutors of the innocent Jews, black truth-tellers seeking to uplift their people, such as Booker T. Washington, Marcus M. Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, have all been scapegoated as anti-Semites and cast as ignorant Jim Conleys seeking to oppress the easily victimized Jews. Jews persecute others and profit off them while portraying themselves as victims. Thus, black anti-Semitism, in quotes, was invented and deployed in 1913 as the Jews' weapon of choice to control and frustrate black political and economic progress and thereby maintain the Jews' profitable and central role in the infrastructure of American white supremacy. In Leo Frank's name, the Jews reclaim the biblical high ground, which they have used to counter and even bury the explicit role they have played in the murderous 400-year history of white Western expansion. And in Frank's name, they have eluded their monumental culpability for white supremacy's profoundly negative effects on the black and indigenous communities the world over. Further, Jews have used the Leo Frank legend to recast themselves as innocent victims of a violent American racism, indistinguishable from that faced by blacks. And in so doing, the Jewish people have, in one fell swoop, expropriated the identity of the black man and woman and synchronized the Jew's image with the familiar biblical narrative. Just as the younger brother Jacob grabbed the heel of his older brother Esau, thus stealing his identity and birthright, so too have the Jews in America falsely claimed to be co-sufferers with blacks, using the legend of Leo Frank as their proof of a, quote, shared history of oppression and persecution. A measure of Leo Frank's century-long potency as a rhetorical armor for American Jews is the Anti-Defamation League's 2015 announcement of a major national initiative to combat anti-Semitism. The newly appointed national director, Jonathan Greenblatt, chose August 17th, the 100th anniversary of Frank's lynching, for its launch date, with Greenblatt invoking Frank's name multiple times. A few months later, in 2016, when this book came out, his just-retired predecessor, Abraham Foxman, announced the plan for a new, quote, Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism, citing a single American example, Leo Frank. Without question, the case is the most used and abused bludgeon for promoting the illegitimate concept of Jewish-American victimhood. The Jews' alleged fear of becoming victims of violent anti-Semitism, quote, like Leo Frank, disguises the inherent hypocrisy of their stance and obscures their true role as America's wealthiest and most successful power brokers. Next section, A Jewish American Messiah. To American Jews, belief in the innocence of Leo Frank is an article of faith, one that artfully and adeptly links a prodigal people to the Israelite ancients. The problem Jews now face is that Leo Frank was no Rosa Parks, who was born in 1913, the year of Mary Fagan's death, the mother of the civil rights movement, whose personal background, grace, and dignity made her ideal to carry a movement for justice on her shoulders. Well, she was a commie operative as well, and the whole thing was planned. They don't tell you. Jews were literally sold Leo Frank as a Jewish American Messiah before they fully grasped his questionable character, his seedy motives, and his true identity as the murderer of Mary Fagan. The greatest advertising mind in America, Albert Lasker, skillfully canonized a justly convicted murderer as the modern Ancient of Days. So impressive was Lasker's biblical rebranding that Frank himself participated in the grand messianic delusion. When Georgia's former governor, Joseph M. Brown, professed his belief in Frank's guilt, the convict complained, quote, "What a spectacle! An ex-governor joining with unreserved approval the mob who cry, 'Crucify, crucify,' like this little bastard is Jesus himself." As the chorus of people calling for Frank's conviction grew, Frank drew a direct comparison for his Bible Belt neighbors. Quote, "I feel toward them like the great Nazarene who said, 'Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do.'" Leo Wise, son of the founder of Reform Judaism, was the editor of the American Israelite, the voice of American Judaism. He fed Frank's messianic complex. Quote, "Judge Roan, in listening to its clamor and even yielding to it, has the appearance of being governed by the same motives as are ascribed in the Gospels to Pontius Pilate in another trial held about 1900 years ago." Governor John Slayton, too, was caught up in the passion of Leo Frank as he described his reasons for sparing the convict's life. Quote, 2,000 years ago, another governor, Pontius Pilate, washed his hands of a case and turned a Jew over to a mob. For 2,000 years, that governor's name has been accursed. If today another Jew were lying in his grave because I had failed to do my duty, I would all through life find his blood on my hands and would consider myself an assassin through cowardice. So there were cucks even back then. And such an image worked just as planned. Jeffrey Melnick perceptively points out that only after Frank's lynching could the term Jew be used to designate one who suffers. Only after Frank's lynching could the term Jew be used to designate one who suffers. According to historian Jason Schulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, quote, "Before a serious Zionist movement developed to bring them together, and before the era of a unified response to the Holocaust, German and Russian Jews were united in their reaction to the Frank affair." Even before Zionism and before the so-called Holocaust, Leo Frank united Russian and German Jews who were socially apart. Simultaneously, as the Frank affair forced Jews inward, it also gathered them outward acceptance in the American milieu. Put simply, the Frank affair was an opportune moment for Americanization. It may be time to consider that in the 1910s, anti-Semitism in the South may actually have helped Jews as an ethnic people in America. For that reason, Schulman quite accurately considers the Frank case to be, quote, a turning point in Jewish American history. So what does Leo Frank represent? That's the section here, a turning point in Jewish-American history. Leo Frank, a turning point. In no less of a way than the Holocaust would later become to world Jewry. So successfully was this fraudulent 1915 narrative implanted in the American mind that a century later an unsuspecting public has almost no knowledge of the Jewish presence in America prior to that time. On that blank slate was written a new and unrecognizable history of Jewish America, one that portrayed the Jewish people as defenders of the weak and the poor, and as champions of racial justice and political equality. And just like that, Leo Frank's new and enhanced resume has him giving birth to the Anti-Defamation League as the country's most outspoken opponent of anti-Semitism, and it makes him the father of the civil rights movement and the from-the-grave leader of the fight against lynching. Blacks, who pioneered and led both these movements, were replaced, in effect, by the saga of Leo Frank. In the Christian world, time itself started over with the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, and the world followed suit, marking its historical timeline by his life and resurrection. Significantly, the Frank affair enabled American Jews to begin their history with the plight of the man Lasker and Ox had christened a Jewish American Messiah. The history that came before the Leo Frank affair was buried. So Jewish history in America before Leo Frank was buried, and a new Jewish identity for a modern era was born. Blacks were the most deceived by this ruse. Before Leo Frank, Jews were the black man's open enemy. After Leo Frank, Jews were the black man's, quote, best friend. From worst enemy to best friend is what Leo Frank accomplished. Turning point in Jewish history, and also a turning point in the relations between blacks and Jews. Leo Frank's Anti-Black Attack, subsection, bottom of 475. Incredibly, this new Leo Frank-fostered image of Jews as crusaders for racial justice was accomplished even though there is probably no better example of Jewish racism than that shown by the Jews who fought for the exoneration of Leo Frank. In the very first World Forum, where blacks and Jews were in formal courtroom confrontation, the top Jewish leaders in America chose a particularly vicious form of racism as their chief weapon to fight for Frank. They chose a, quote, Negro testimony, quote, Negro crime, quote, smell of nigger motif over all the formidable weapons in their intellectual arsenal, over all the Old Testament history and wisdom they were privy to, over all the cultural richness of the Jewish diaspora, over all the voluminous ancient midrash or rabbinical commentary on the words of the prophets. It was a shocking reminder of past black Jewish encounters at the auction blocks in Africa and throughout the Caribbean and the Americas, and, unfortunately, an accurate predictor of many future black Jewish disputes and interactions. In examining the trial nearly a century later, Jeffrey Melnick writes, quote, even if we accept that Frank had nothing to do with Mary Fagan's death, it is still necessary, for instance, to examine the ways Frank and his supporters used racist language to demean Conley and took refuge in what they understood to be the privilege of Jewish whiteness. 10 years after Leo Frank's guilty verdict and its many judicial reaffirmations, the ADL was unapologetically charging that a black man was guilty of the murder of Mary Fagan. Again, it reviewed the trial 30 years later, and the most prominent Jewish rights organization in America considered the Frank team's injection of, quote, the race-religious issue into the trial as merely a, quote, calculated risk, which in, quote, a different stage setting might well have succeeded. Over 100 years later, the Jewish leadership continues to accuse the much maligned black man. But James Conley represented his own humanity with an inner strength and dignity that cannot be easily dismissed or diminished. Conley says, quote, I know I will be either hanged or get a life sentence, but I am prepared to take my medicine. I wrote the notes, and I helped carry the body to the basement, and I know they can punish me for that. When the judge calls me up before him, I'm going to ask him not to ask me any questions, but to simply sentence me. If it's to hang, I'll stick to my story, and if it's life imprisonment, there'll be no change. It makes no difference what the sentence is. I'll have nothing to add and nothing to take away from the statement I made to the detectives. So he bore up pretty high characterly, let's say, did the modest black sweeper janitor. It is that spirit which allowed him to face down the finest lawyers in the South and to withstand the focused collective assault of the world's wealthiest and most powerful people until the truth prevailed. By striking contrast, Leo Frank, the actual killer, admitted no errors, accepted no responsibility, and took no blame. The Frank case drove more white people, especially Jews, to re-examine the bestial practice of lynching. Before Frank's death, Jews generally, North and South, viewed the lynching of blacks as a useful and necessary feature of America's, quote, justice system, both tacitly and overtly supporting terror as a form of social control. But after Frank's demise, the Jewish Criterion warned its readers that lynching might be an American social policy worth reviewing, not because black blood had been shed, but because a white Jew was thought to have also become a victim. After all, the racist editors asked, quote, what is to prevent a white man from being lynched tomorrow? And if one white man, why not another? There actually were whites who were lynched during all the period blacks were, for the same reasons. Rabbi Jacob Goldstein of Frank's childhood hometown of Brooklyn declared that the Frank case, not the multitude of black lynchings, quote, furnishes the strongest argument, unquote, against capital punishment. The black editors of the New York Age noted scathingly the overdue energy directed at stopping lynching in the United States. Quote, now that a white man and a Jew with thousands of dollars behind his cause is the victim, there's a cry to make lynching a federal crime. As long as Negroes alone had been lynched, the whole country has been content to let the pastime continue. The Chicago Defender similarly opined in a headline. It's another black paper. Strange contrast in the thousands of letters sent the governor of Georgia asking for the clemency for condemned Jew and the silence that follows the lynching of an African American. In the same week Leo Frank was arrested, three blacks were lynched in Georgia. And on the day of the Frank verdict, Joe McNeely, a black man, was taken from a hospital in Charlotte, North Carolina, and shot to death by a mob of whites. That same day, Virgil Swanson, accused of murder, was lynched near Greenville, South Carolina, and a few days later, someone else confessed to the crime. Some relief did come, but not, ironically, from the justice-crusading Jewish leadership. Rather, it was the leader of the Leo Frank prosecution, Hugh Dorsey, who, when he became governor of Georgia in 1917 to 1921, ultimately championed black rights. When first confronted with the horrific 1918 lynching of the pregnant Mary Turner, whose womb was ripped open and her unborn child crushed into the ground by the heel of a white man's boot, Dorsey retreated to the expedient trope that the cause of lynching was black misbehavior. And in this, he no doubt found support from Jewish leaders. In 1921, however, Dorsey had a remarkable change of view and published a groundbreaking study titled A Statement from Governor Hugh M. Dorsey as to the Negro in Georgia. It detailed 135 incidents of racial injustice, including lynching, peonage, and other crimes against blacks that had occurred over a two-year period. He wrote, quote, Hugh Dorsey, to me it seems that we stand indicted as a people before the world. If the conditions indicated by these charges should continue, both God and man would justly condemn Georgia more severely than man and God have condemned Belgium and Leo Frank for the Congo atrocities. There's a Belgian colony in Africa. But worse than that condemnation would be the destruction of our civilization by the continued toleration of such cruelties in Georgia. He called for the repeal of the state's oppressive peonage law and for the enactment of the anti-lynching statutes that would give the governor powers to intervene to stop lynchings and to prosecute mob members. The NAACP considered Dorsey's stand an exciting development because a governor from the Deep South, quote, greatly enhanced the significance of the anti-lynching crusade. Dorsey's pioneering efforts on behalf of black rights have been obscured by the historical taint applied to him by supporters of Leo Frank. Quite to the contrary, Lewis Marshall, the most prominent Jewish leader in America, the number one Jew, as he thought himself, stood with the hardened white supremacist in opposing the 1922 Dyer anti-lynching bill, Dyer anti-lynching bill, which, at his urging, went down to defeat in the U.S. Senate. Next subsection is called Frank's Impact on America, one epigraph. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Matthew 24:28. That means chapter 24, verse 28. The Frank case affected other aspects of American society as well. It drew attention to the conditions facing, quote, factory girls and child laborers, and very likely hastened the reforms then underway. One of Atlanta's largest periodicals thereafter pressured, quote, every Southern legislator who refused to vote for child labor reforms, labeling the lawmakers as potential murderers. For factory managers like Frank, who operated their businesses as self-serving heirs of the plantation slave barons, such reforms probably made their routine exploitation and sexual abuse of workers a more difficult proposition. The national reverberations, the national reverberations of the Leo Frank case provided Jews some immediate political benefits. Less than a year after the Frank lynching, Louis Brandeis, a Jew, was nominated to the Supreme Court. According to his biographer, quote, the Leo Frank case had sensitized people to anti-Semitism, and senators did not want their opposition of Brandeis, however soundly based, to be interpreted as prejudice. Brandeis's success offers an almost perfect example of how the false narrative of anti-Semitism became the Jews' weapon of war, quote unquote. The Frank case provided the Jewish elite with the smokescreen necessary to achieve their political objectives. Never let a lynching go to waste, Rahm Emanuel might say in a later year. A further benefit for Jewish leaders was that the Frank affair coincided with one of the boldest power grabs in world history, the setting up of the Federal Reserve System, the private banking conglomerate that consolidated all the nation's financial resources into the hands of an elite set of Wall Street bankers. As with the Brandeis appointment, the anti-Semitic firestorm over the Frank case, concocted as it was, served a blunt criticism about the fact that the principals in the Fed operation were Jewish. One of them, Kuhn Loeb and Company's president Jacob Schiff, had a clandestine personal relationship and business arrangement with Frank's savior, Georgia Governor John Slayton, an association that lasted well after the lynching. The fact is that blacks and Jews could not have seen the Leo Frank trial in the same way. Just as the interests of the slave and slave master are by nature irreconcilable, so it is with those of blacks and Jews. Once the Leo Frank case is properly contextualized, it will be seen for what it is, a masterly century-long deception designed to maintain a highly profitable and exploitative black-Jewish slave-slave-master relationship. I remember the Mossad slogan is by way of deception, and that's what the blacks at Nation of Islam are concluding about the Leo Frank case. It is a masterly century-long deception designed to maintain a highly profitable and exploitative black-Jewish slave-slave-master relationship. In the end, whoever lynched Leo Frank lynched one of their own white brethren. His crime violated the Southern cultural code of conduct, having upset a delicate balance that Jews had achieved with Gentiles in America. It was the rare instance where the crime was seen as so egregious that not even the tried and true, quote, Negro crime defense could extricate Frank from the consequences of his own misdeeds. Were it not for the white Gentiles of Georgia, in this case, at least two innocent black men would have paid with their lives, scapegoated not only to protect a prominent Jewish leader, but also to preserve the reputation of the, quote unquote, chosen people. Truth has now caught up with history and corrected a century-old injustice perpetrated against both Mary Fagan and James Connolly. Ultimately, a divine tribunal will hold America accountable for implementing and maintaining a system built on the blood, sweat, and tears of the real children of Israel, the black man and woman of America. Somewhere on the docket will be a review of the Mary Fagan murder case, at which time the travesties of the Frank affair and the crimes of all the leading figures in the case will be laid bare. But not before that tribunal hears the millions of prior cases where the brown, the black, the red, and the poor white were the innocent victims. And not before that highest of courts holds accountable the architects and beneficiaries of the very system that destroyed countless lives, including those of Mary Fagan, James Connolly, and even Leo Frank. That's the end of the book on page 481. And then 482 has three pictures. First, the site of the National Pencil Company, 37 South Forsyth Street, where Mary Fagan was murdered. Now, the Sam Nunn Federal Center. I think Sam Nunn was a senator from Georgia at one point. Then there's pictures of, two pictures of Mary Fagan's gravestone. One reads, celebrated in song as Little Mary Fagan after her murder at age 13 on April 26, 1913 in Atlanta. The trial and conviction of Leo Frank were controversial, as was the commutation of his death sentence 4 days before Confederate veterans marked her grave on June 25, 1915. He was abducted from prison and lynched August 17, 1915. In 1986, he was issued a pardon. So that sign exculpates Jews. And then finally, the caption reads in the fourth photo, view from Mary Fagan's gravesite at Old Marietta Cemetery in Marietta, Georgia. Finally, an epilogue, which is a couple-page letter from the parents, as I said, and that will conclude. Or no, let me see here. A statement about Mary Fagan will be the last thing. I didn't notice that it comes after. But first of all, the epilogue. The mother and the stepfather of Mary Fagan write, is the subsection, to the Honorable Thomas E. Watson, remember the Goy newspaperman and magazine writer who stood up to the national media campaign put together by Albert Lasker. So Mary Fagan's parents write to the Honorable Thomas E. Watson, dear sir, as the mother and father of Mary Fagan, our poor daughter, we feel it our duty to write you a letter expressing our sincere thanks for your noble efforts in the publishing in your paper the truth about the Frank case. While we know that our advantages in life have been limited and we are not as wise and foreseeing as some folks, we do know that we are correct in the assertion that the great daily newspapers in Atlanta and elsewhere in the state have deliberately failed and refused to speak out the truth in the Frank case concerning the death of our precious little daughter. These papers, of course, have been controlled by the rich Jews who advertise in their papers, and they have not dared to publish to the world anything that was calculated to fix this crime on Leo M. Frank, where it unquestionably belongs. And in our sorrow, we feel that you are the only one that we can turn to for an expression of the truth. And we find consolation in the fact that one man, through one paper, has bravely held up for our cause and has exposed the dirty work of deception and perjury as it has appeared all along in the progress of the case. We are sorry that our former governor, J.M. Slayton, has seen fit to override the judgment of 12 impartial, honest jurors, the judgments of the courts, both high and low, and also the judgment of the great masses of the people. We feel sorry that he should do this when we take into consideration the fact that for 2 years after his trial, not a scintilla of evidence was brought forward in his defense, although we had numerous men employed to work in the case, and all that they could bring forward was some alleged affidavits, which one in their number swore to be false. We are sorry to say, but the spirit in our souls compel us to say, that which could not be done in front of 12 honest men, nor through the courts all the way to the United States Supreme Court, has been done by the governor of Georgia through Jew money and influence. We are sorry to say that the man whom we supported for governor of Georgia was so weak and so little to succumb to these influences, and we pray to God that Georgia shall never have another man to sit in her executive chair. It appears to us as if Slayton thought the rich Jew whom his partner represented was innocent. Why in the name of God didn't he free him altogether? Why should he only commute his sentence? To our minds, there was no middle ground whatsoever. We can't possibly see why a man guilty of so heinous an offense should have his sentence mitigated. We both were in attendance at the trial each day. We heard the evidence. We noticed Frank's attitude and his actions all through the trial, and we know beyond any question of a doubt that Leo Max Frank is the guilty man. If we had any doubts as to Frank's guilt at any stage during the trial, we would have been the first so to declare. While personally we wanted the murderer of our young daughter punished, we wanted it more so for the fact that if the offender of this heinous crime was brought to sure and swift punishment, it would deter others. We had hoped that by the sure and certain punishment of Frank, that no other young Georgia girl budding into womanhood would die a horrible death defending her virtue against a rich, depraved sodomite Jew. We feel that justice delayed has been justice denied. We cannot help but feel that the man, be he rich or poor, who unquestionably murdered our poor daughter while she was defending her virtue and honesty, the principle of which we had been so careful in teaching her from childhood, should pay the death penalty. We cannot help but believe that Slayton, who by his acts as an official has been a traitor to the people of Georgia, a traitor to law and justice, and a traitor to the womanhood of Georgia. In conclusion, we will say that while the flowers bloom about the last resting place of our dear innocent child, and we are left to tread the balance of our life on the dreary path of sorrow, we must declare our deep feelings of gratitude to you, Mr. Watson, for your brave and patriotic attitude in this case. And it does seem to us that you, along with the fearless and noble Georgian Hugh M. Dorsey, deserve the unlimited and everlasting admiration for your loyalty to a cause that involves the great issue between money and fair play with the common people of our state. And that was a very nice letter, and that was written and submitted respectfully yours, Mr. and Mrs. J.W. Coleman. So that was her stepfather's name, of Mary Fagan. And then finally, one last two-page segment, and we'll finish. A statement about Mary Fagan. Quote, "Oh, I'm so lonely without her. I never had but one sister, and she's gone. Oh, God, I just feel as if I could die." That was Mary Fagan's older sister, Ollie Fagan, O-L-L-I-E Fagan, in April 1913. So that would be like this within days of her death, because her death was at the end of the month. And Nation of Islam says, "The young murder victim at the center of this tragic episode in American history is 13-year-old Mary Fagan. She was more than a factory girl, quote-unquote, as many accounts contemptuously refer to her. She was a child of one of the millions of poor working families caught in a major economic upheaval in America after the demise of chattel slavery. The many academic analyses of this case have almost entirely removed the murdered girl from consideration in favor of the one person they insist is the real victim, Leo Frank. Indeed, the case became internationally notable not out of sympathy for its young strangled victim, but because of the prosecution and ultimate lynching of her convicted murderer. Thus, the name of Mary Fagan has no historical meaning, while the name Leo Frank carries the status of national tragedy." The labeling of Mary Fagan as a, quote, factory girl harks back to a time in American history when blacks were commonly classified as rice Negroes or cotton Negroes or house Negroes, not only bought and sold as slaves, but also categorized by their sellers as having a particular lifelong manual labor obligation. In Mary's time, 50 years after slavery's demise, America's heirs of the slave system made only rhetorical alterations to that highly profitable economic model, such that through a sophisticated debt system, a sharecropper or tenant farmer became the wholly owned property of the landholder or merchant, and an employer of young women and girls in the industrial South believed that when he hired the help, he bought his female employees, like he could use them like however he wanted, including sexually. This was the operational power dynamic that resulted in the tragic death of Mary Fagan at her factory workplace. And it is that same dynamic which has misdirected the scholars of the case. And though this volume has grappled with the legal, social, racial, economic, religious, and political details of that sordid affair, we must never lose sensitivity for the suffering that young Mary experienced at the hands of her brutal murderer. This concludes Nation of Islam. It is to Mary Fagan and her family that we dedicate this volume, as well as to all the many innocents, white and black, who became victims of the circumstances and events surrounding her murder. Our conviction about the case is reflected in the title, the lynching of a guilty man. But our goal has been to right a massive wrong and bring justice to an innocent young girl who, one day in April 1913, sought to collect her meager pay of $1.20, never suspecting it to be the last day of her life. And that's a rather nice, polite, respectful ending from Louis Farrakhan's group, Nation of Islam. And you can see that it's Jews who are a people of the lie. Blacks are not a people of the lie like Jews. They may lie more frequently than whites do, but it doesn't define them the way I really think that this book shows, and this incident and affair proves, that they are. They are. The Jews have legitimately earned the title the people of the lie. Because the one thing you never note, they may tell different lies, or this Jew may even admit, they may give a little back, they may go two steps forward, one step back, three steps forward, two steps back, that kind of thing. But they're all the Jews are moving in the same direction. All the Jews have the same end goal in mind. And there's not one scholar who will stand up and say, with any of these books, transcripts, etc., 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 we've been reading about Leo Frank, prove, which is that he's guilty. Not one Jew will stick to the facts and just admit the whole thing flat out. And that makes Jews, politically, a very, very, very dangerous people. And it means, the meaning of it for whites is that you cannot take Jews as individuals. You must take them as a committed group. You must see them as essentially erect, brainful, mindful termites, human termites who are working together as a colony to destroy our society and to destroy the basis of our nation. Just as this one little Jew destroyed Mary Fagan. And to respond to this team, we need to form our own Team White. And that's going to be my conclusion. I'll leave you with that. Thank you for listening. This has been the Nation of Islam's The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, put out by the researchers at the Nation of Islam out of Chicago in 2016. You can buy the book from them. Do buy it from them, not from the Jews at Amazon. The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews is a series, and this is the third volume of that series. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything I record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Thanks again, and I'll be back with you with more very important material real soon.